We're back. We're live in New York. Live in Queens. Hang on just a second. Okay. Now, we've got 80 minutes for the CD. I don't know how long this is going to go, but we'll just let the Spirit guide us. It always happens like this Sunday morning. We're bearing down to the maddest of the mad dogs. You know, I had an agenda and for how I wanted this to go, and God always seems to laugh at that. That got blown out of the water. We had wanted to do, I don't know if you've heard it from us this weekend, but we really, really believe that amends are important. You know, and I was talking to someone this morning about this. You talk to people, you know, they're 5, 10, 15 years in sobriety, whatever it is, sometimes 20, 25 years in sobriety. They say, I'm really depressed. I'm really, you know, I'm having trouble. Everything's flat. You know, I don't know what's wrong. First question we always ask, you got any unfinished amends? Okay. I don't think anything eats your lunch worse than unfinished amends. And, you know, I think it's the cause of most, you know, typical depressions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. You know, Ed was talking about it this morning. He had severe depression. You know, he worked the steps and the depression went away. Bill Wilson, what was he, 14 years sober. Father Ed Dowling catches him in New York, asks him this horrible question, Bill, have you ever worked these steps? And he's, you know, indignant. Well, I wrote them. He said, I didn't ask you that. Have you ever worked them, you know? And Bill's, you know, finally gets on and says, no, I never did. You know, tell you the truth, I laid in a bed in Towns Hospital and Ebby asked me some questions. I answered them and had an experience, but I never really worked them to depth. I never did it again, the working and reworking of the steps, okay? And so Ed says, well, I'm willing to, you know, boogie with you if you are. And he says yes, and the depression is lifted for Bill because he goes through and he does these things that he only wrote about, you know? And so anyway, that's that little lecture. But nothing has set me as free as making my amends. Don used to say, you don't do this because you're guilty. That's not why you do it. Okay? He said, the essence of this thing is if I owe you, I have to pay you. Okay? It's just that simple. If I owe you, I have to pay you. I don't cut deals with the amends. But for me, and, you know, Don didn't like this, but, and I hopefully, I will evolve more spiritually so that I get to the plane that he was at, but I do a lot of it because it makes me feel, you know, I can sleep better at night after I've done it. You know, I do it for my own peace of mind, a lot of it. I know it's not why we do it. The idea is there's something between me and you, there's something between me and God, okay? And I can't be effective working with God's kids if I'm carrying all this baggage with me. That's why we do four-step. That's why we do nine-step, okay? Don simplified it for me one time. He said, here's what it boils down to. 80% of them just want to hear you say you were wrong. The other 20% want their money back. Hey, pretty simple deal. I'm going to tell a quick story. That's more of a four-step story than it is a nine-step story, but I talked to Michelle earlier, and I hope this will be helpful. May or may not, just depends. There's a lady in AA. She's a very virtuous, sober AA woman, and she's out on one horribly cold winter night crossing a four-lane highway. I mean, it's really cold, freezing cold. She's giggling. As she stands on the shoulder looking across the highway, she hears something. It sounds like a squeak at first, and then she realizes it's a voice, and the voice is going, please help me. Please help me. I'm freezing. And she looks down, and there's a snake down laying at her feet, and a fairly large snake, and it's stiff, but it's speaking to her. And he goes, please help me. And she goes, my God, a snake that can talk. It goes, help you. What are you saying? What could I do for you? Please carry me across the road. I'm freezing. I can't get across the road. She goes, my God, carry you across the road? No. She says, wait, that's crazy. You're a snake. You'd bite me. And the voice goes, I wouldn't bite someone who helped me. Please carry me across the road. And she kind of looks around. She thinks she's going crazy, but she says, well, all right, okay, you know, I'd like to help you. And she reaches down, and the snake's just almost stiff, and she's got on a down jacket. And she puts the snake in under her down jacket, and she starts across the road with it. Well, she crosses the four lanes, and she gets to the other side, and she can feel that her body warmth has warmed the snake up, and it's wriggling a little bit, you know. And so she reaches in and takes it out, and she's gently putting it down, and just as she does, it bites her a good one right on the hand, and she drops it. She goes, oh, my God. She goes, I helped you. You promised me that you wouldn't bite me, and you did. And the snake, it's not squeaking. It goes, you knew my nature when you picked me up. Okay? And the idea is, how many snakes have I picked up, knowing full well what their nature was, over and over and over again, and then I'm pissed off because the snake does what it can only do. Okay? It's just something to think about. I don't know if that's helpful. You know, we have a friend. He's a Native American friend of ours, and I don't see him very often except when he needs something. And then he's right, and he lives around the corner from us. And he recently asked me for a loan of $100, and I don't lend our money. It's our money, so I don't lend it out or give it out, you know, unless I talk to my wife, because it's our stuff. And I said, this guy, you know, he asked me for a $100 loan. You know, do you mind if I do that? And she said, yes, I mind. She said, you're not going to loan it to him. You can give him $100 if you want, but you're not going to loan it to him because you know full well it's a setup for resentment. We clear on that? You know that one. Don't lend money in AA, just give it. You know, you probably owe it some places in amend anyway. You know what I'm saying? So, but or if you want to have a resentment, lend the money. It's a good way to do that. It'll work, I promise you. Okay. Here's a few things, and then I want to tell a few stories, and we're going to have to move on out of here. It says, we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. I'm on 76. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. This is the theme of the whole big book, okay? They hammer you in the third step with it. They talk about it in the fourth step. They're talking about it again. I live life on self-will. I step on the toes of my fellows. They retaliate. Then I get mad, blame them for it, okay? It's the way I've lived my whole life. They're going to, what we're going to miss this morning, unfortunately, is the family afterwards. My favorite, personal favorite chapter in the whole book. You know, there's people who say, don't worry about that, just read Working Through Others and you learn about the 12 steps. Well, the 12 steps says we practice these principles in all our affairs. And I find those principles laid out mostly in the family afterwards. Some in the chapter to wives, a little bit in employers, and a little bit in a vision to you, but basically, the family afterwards is loaded with. They say giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle, and they talk about how in the family everybody's trying to exert their will, they want their own way, and it causes discord and unhappiness in the family. Okay, same theme that we've got all the way through. When I insist on my way, it blows up in my face, and it's happened all my life, and I'm still trying to learn the lesson at almost 60 years old. Incredible deal. But anyway, what has caused these problems is my effort to run the show myself and live on a self-will basis. If I haven't the will to do this, meaning clean up the debris, then I ask until it comes. I ask God. I pray for the willingness. But here's the kicker, and this is a good thing to remember when you're working with other people. I don't know if you guys do what we do, but I'm a busy cat. I'm really busy. I run a construction business, and I sponsor too many people. And, you know, I go to meetings when I can. I'm always at my home group. I have children and grandchildren. I try to be a part of their lives. I think that's what, you know, somebody said, if your program doesn't work at home, your program doesn't work. That's all there is to it. I mean, that's a good way to judge it. So I don't have much time. I have zero time to waste, okay? Almost 60 years old, got hep C. We don't know how long I'm going to be on the planet. You know, I don't have time to waste, and neither do you, because your time is precious and you've been given a great gift, okay? So I sit down with the person and I say, why do you want to do this? You know, let's talk about it. And this is what going to any lengths might look like. It's pretty hairy stuff. I mean, it's not just stuff you do for fun and amusement, okay? I mean, you've heard some of that. So do we have an agreement? Do we have a little contract here that you're willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? Okay? And you now know what going to any length would look like because I've explained it to you. And they always say yes, you know. Half of them bag it, but they always say yes in the beginning. But this is kind of, you know, I write contracts. I'm a general contractor. And this is the kind of thing that I might pull out if it were a contract later when we have a discrepancy, you know, in some construction project. Is, oh, whoa, whoa, remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol, in italics, which meant they were screaming at you. That's what the old-timers used to say. They're yelling at you when they put it in italics. If you've seen a first edition, it's in large case, caps, right? You've seen it. Probably there's still some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel diffident, which means you don't want to do it. You feel bad about it, about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. It says, don't worry about that. You're not going to have to do that. God bless you. You might prejudice them anyway. At the moment, we're trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Juanita read it. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. Let's see. There's a couple of these that I wanted to read to you. Go ahead. I'll find them.
Here's a good one on page 77. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. You get that?
Yep.
We go to make amends. We don't criticize them, or we don't argue.
Okay. I'm back on it.
All right.
hold that thought. Let's see. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Don used to say, this is the truth of the thing. Because I am wrong doesn't mean you're right, but I can't dwell on that. That'll mess me up, okay? But just to know that that's true. And he may have done more harm to me than I've done to him, but I'm the fish I've got to catch. It doesn't matter what they've done. That's the piece I have to get. That's the piece that's so important. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It's harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. Here's the direction. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Okay? We were taught a formula, and I might go back to this, and the formula is this. I go to the person or call them on the phone. Sometimes I don't want to arrive in your life because last time in your life wasn't so wonderful. And I don't want to be, and one of the things that I did, Don did this too, I was a surprise in people's lives. They didn't know what to expect, okay? It wasn't normally good, but it wasn't always horrible, but you never knew, okay? And that's not good. That upsets people. So I don't want to pop back into your life and be a surprise again. Typically, I'll call you on the phone or write you a letter, okay? This is what I'm up to, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got to do everything in my power to take care of the, you know, mess I made out of my life prior. I believe that I've harmed you, and would you please, you know, be willing to listen to me about some harm that I caused you? If they say no, thanks anyway. Wonderful hearing from you. Go and have a good life. I don't want to talk to you anymore. Then that's great. That's it. But Don taught me that I have to stay willing, that if it should ever come up that I could make that amends, okay, that I will make it in the future. That's that willingness piece, to hold on to that, okay? But if they say, well, okay, you know, I will talk to you, then I make an appointment, you know, and I've made the approach, and now I go to see them. 9 times out of 10, the harm that I did was not over the telephone or by letter. It was face-to-face in person. That's the way I like to hurt you, you know, up close and personal. So I was taught that the nature of my amends should be similar to the nature of the harm, that if I did it in person, I make the amends directly in person if possible. Now, some people are willing to talk to me on the telephone. They don't want to see me face-to-face, and I honor that. And I say, well, thank you. Some people, they say, I don't want to see you. I don't want to talk about it. And I ask them, well, would you mind if I wrote you a letter? I mean, would that be okay? Okay. And most people say, well, yeah, that would be all right. The big book talks about some people cannot be seen. We write them an honest letter. That's what we do. Okay, that's the direction. So if they'll see me, I go to them and I say, you know, this is the harm that I believe that I caused you. Okay. Now, before I barge in and talk about harm I caused them, I talk to my sponsor. I say, how do you think this sounds? Okay? And sometimes they'll reflect it back to me. They'll say, well, how would that sound to you if somebody came to you and said that? And sometimes I say, well, I think it would hurt me. I'd be pissed off to hear all that. They say, exactly. Don't say it like that. Don't say those things. Say these things. Okay? And we work it until it's not going to hurt the person. I mean, it's some work to be done. I call that 8-step work, you know, working with your sponsor to figure out how the deal ought to be. We talked about the cards. Did we talk about the cards this weekend? No. Index cards? No? A pile of index cards, right on them, you know, what are they, 3x5? Right at the top, this is the person, this is their last known address, phone number, email, whatever. This is the harm I'm clear on, you know, and or if I don't have the address and all that, find. Okay, fine.
3 piles, at least for me. Pile that I'm willing to make, amends I'm willing to make, middle pile where I'm not too sure I'm willing to make them, and then, bless you, there's the never in hell will I ever make these amends pile.
Yeah. What we find, and I know a bunch of you have also, is that as you start making the willings, then the not so willing become, oh, that's not a big deal, I made these others. And finally, once you make those, that I'll never in hell do it, become possible to do. At least that's my experience, hers too. So I say, this is the harm that I'm clear on, and, you know, I'm pretty selfish, and I've been a tornado through people's lives. I mean, I don't say it like that, but I express it. And is there any harm that I didn't mention that you could tell me about, that I caused you? Some people get in this thing of how did it make you feel and all that. That's too complicated for me. I'm a simpleton. You know, I also never graduated high school like Ed, you know.
They'll tell you if they want you to know.
Yeah, exactly. I try to keep it a little simpler, and I say, you know, is there any harm that I caused you that I haven't mentioned that you could tell me about? And then my direction is shut up and listen. Mm-hmm. Okay, Juanita just read this part. I don't argue with them, okay. When I made amends to my mother, I didn't even have to ask her if there was any harm that I hadn't mentioned. Man, she had a whole, you know, boatload of it. And, you know, it was my job to sit there and then you. And anyway, so shut up and listen. Okay, real good. If you start retaliating and do that and get into arguing with them, then eventually you'll either drink or you'll have to go back and make amends for the sloppy amends you did, which is really humiliating. I've done that twice. Okay, don't do that. Don't argue with them. It's not worth it. And the kicker is, what can I now do to make this right? You know, Don used to say, even the books. I don't know about that, but what can I now do to make this right between us and clean this up? And then shut up and listen and be willing to do, you know, what anything they might ask. Am I still on? Am I still? Okay. I've told you about, you know, I interacted with Don before he was my sponsor and stuff. And when I first got to know Don, I hadn't made all my amends, and I was really worried about it. And I said, Don, I need to ask you something because I'm concerned about this. You know, I mistreated a lot of women. I owe a lot of amends to past girlfriends. I owe a bunch of money, you know, because I basically robbed people. I didn't rob them with guns and stuff, but I would borrow your money and then move 2,000 miles away. And it's out of sight, out of mind. And that was 30 years ago anyway. It doesn't really, you know. Guy told me what did he say? The subconscious knows no statute of limitations. no statute of limitations for the subconscious. And that's true. It'll eat you alive no matter how. I've paid back debts over 30 years prior, and the weight that is lifted when I've done it is amazing. And now I completely lost my place. Let's see. Where was I? Oh, so I'm talking to Don, and I said, here's my fear, Don. I'm afraid that if I go back to some of these old girlfriends, I was pretty selfish, right? I was a pretty selfish lover and just a selfish guy in general. And what if they say to me, well, you can make it right by hopping in the sack with me, okay? And you're not laughing. Usually people laugh when I tell this story. Anyway, Don didn't laugh. I'm sure he wanted to, but he didn't. By the way, not one girlfriend has asked that, you know, just for the record. He kept a straight face, and I said, well, what if I go back and I owed him $1,000, and they say I want $20,000, you know? And he said, Tom, let me ask you something. He said, would any of that stuff make right the harm that you did? And I said, no, it wouldn't. He said, you didn't ask what can I do to make it worse. You asked what can I do to make it right. And in the improbable instance that they did say something like that, which, they, by the way, they never have, he said, you wouldn't have to honor that because that's not what you asked for. You asked, what can I do to make it right? You know, trust that God is going to take care of this deal. You know, don't worry about it. In every case, it's been more than made right. So they tell you what you can do, and then you're willing to carry that out. And that was the direction I was given. Okay, here's the deal. My former wife, we try not to X out our, you know, we try... That's a long story, but we don't call them exes, okay? They're part, especially if you've had children with them and stuff, they're part of your family. You may not be married to them anymore, but they're part of your family. We say my former, okay? That's just our quirky little thing we do. So my former wife, my first wife, I broke her spirit. I was the worst husband you can imagine. I mean, anything horrible that a husband can do, I did it. Guilty on all counts, Your Honor. And she of my in-laws' four children, she was their favorite, absolutely bar none. I mean, they wouldn't say that, but everybody knew she was their favorite. So I broke the spirit of their favorite child. You know, I was a crappy father to their grandchildren. Okay, to say that they hated me is just it doesn't even come close to how they felt about me. Right? What a bum they thought I was, and I was. So came amends time, and I got to make amends to them. I really don't want to. Last time I talked to my former father-in-law, he told me that he was going to. Here's what he said: we're in a parking lot of a convenience type, little grocery store in Santa Fe. He said, if I ever hear of you laying a hand on my daughter again, I'm going to take you apart like a cheap watch. This is verbatim what he said. Last time I talked to him. It's like 15 years, 20 years prior, something like that. So now I got to go to him and make amends, right? I think my mother-in-law said something to me like, you just broke my heart. That's the last thing she said to me. So now I'm back. I've got to see them. I hate them. They hate me, da-da-da-da. Or I did hate them. I don't anymore because I've done the work on it. I've looked at what I did to set all that up. I don't need to forgive them because I'm the culprit. I made all that happen. Okay, there's no forgiveness necessary. You know, there's remorse on my part. So I'm going to see them, and I'm scared to death. I'm just scared to even talk to them. And I'm praying this prayer, you know, God, please help me. God, please help me. And for some reason, I stop, I pull off the road, and I get out the big book, and I read this piece. And it says, we go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. And what I thought was, you're making this all about you one more time. You hurt these people. You know, you broke the spirit of their daughter. You did this. You know, you're supposed to go to them in a helpful and forgiving spirit. And my prayer changed. And it was, God, show me how I can be helpful to them. Show me how I can heal what's been broken here. Okay? Not help me, give me, but them. What can I do for them? Show me how to go in a helpful and forgiving spirit. I had absolute forgiveness. I mean, there was nothing to forgive anyway. And my focus was on being helpful to them. It was a really great amends, okay? They told me what they wanted me to do. They'd always wanted me to support my children better than I had. My children were grown. They said, you know, help them go to school, go to college, go further if you can. And I said I would do that. And I've helped my kids ever since. I mean, I'd helped them before that. But, you know, that's what I did. I had owed them some money. I said, I have to pay you this money back. They said, we don't want the money. You know, forget about it. And what I did was I took that amount of money and I paid it to their grandchildren, to my kids, because that's, you know, that was where it logically needed to go. I've paid a lot of money back. I'll tell you one quick story. I started drinking on a little island off Cape Cod called Nantucket Island. That's where I started alcoholic drinking, in a place called the Chicken Box. And if you've never been there, don't worry about it. You haven't missed, you've not missed a damn thing. Plywood floors, you know, bucket of blood, Portuguese fishing bar. Anyway, they hadn't served chicken there in 40 years, but still the Chicken Box. And that is where I lived. That's where I had lived there on Nantucket. And for about 3 years, I had a shop there, a retail shop, in the summertime because it was a tourist place. I had a partner. He'd borrowed some money from his aunt to keep the store floating. I promised him I would pay it back, but I don't pay debts back if you're not around, I don't really owe it to you. You know, that's just kind of the way it goes. He had called me over the years and he had asked for this money, you know, I just remember getting scared every time he would do it. And I talked to him when I first got sober, and he said, you interested in paying back your debts? I said, oh, yes, I will when I get on my feet. But, you know, I'm newly sober, and there's nothing I can do, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I would think about it. And do you know about the white noise? Do you know about that? That's that, you know what I'm saying? You're trying to meditate, but this, you owe David that money from 30 years ago. So I would think about it, and I'd feel guilty. I paid, you know, an incredible amount of interest, psychic interest, over the years. But I had it in my head it was $3,500, and I never had $3,500 together, and nobody was telling me, just pay in increments. You know, just start paying. You know what I'm saying? So my mind came up with this, you know, my mind's always there to feed me wonderful, useful information. And what it told me was, you can't afford this. Don't do it. Don't go there. You know, don't call him. Don't, you know, someday you'll have a windfall and you can pay them $3,500. Finally, I'm making amends and I can't stand the white noise. And I find he's in Oakland, California. I find him and call him up. I say, David, this is Tom. And, you know, I've owed you money for almost 30 years. And I'm, you know, trying to stay sober in AA, and I need to pay you back. And here's what he says to me. You know, I was wondering if you would ever pay me that $500 you owed me. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, you've owed me $500, you know. And I was just startled, you know. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to pay you some interest. And he said, well, you could pay me a little interest. That'd be all right. You know, simple interest, whatever. And you know, long story short, I pay it off. But the point of that was my ego that is never my friend, this, you know, my rational mind without God involved, had served up a scenario where I owed the guy $3,500. If I had ever called him like 20 years, you know, 15 years before this, he'd have said, you owe me $500, and I could have paid him 20 times. You see what I'm saying? But instead of doing the right thing, I listen to this, and then I pay interest on a debt that I don't even owe. Okay, again and again and again, and guilt and shame and white noise and all that jazz. I left out a piece. Well, there's some, you know, we could do a weekend on the ninth step. We could, and we could more than do a weekend on the family afterwards. But I want to tell you about a few more that are real important to me. Some people say, okay, background on this. When I got sober in Santa Fe, the inner child was running rampant. I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he was not my friend. What does that mean?
We finish at 1.
Yeah, well, he said we could go longer.
Bart said we have to be out here at 1.
Bart said we could go longer.
Oh, okay.
Didn't he? We okay with that?
One.
One, that's it?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, I got to hustle it up. The inner child was running rampant. Everybody had their therapist. They'd have crystals on the tables in AA meetings. I mean, it's just we were the woo-woo capital of America. If you didn't have a therapist, you couldn't even share at AA practically. And you heard this kind of thing. If anyone brought up the ninth step, then the next person sharing would say, well, you know, my sponsor told me that the step reads, except when to do so would injure them or others, and I'm others, and if it's going to hurt me, I don't have to make the amends. And people would go, oh, yeah, my sponsor told me that too. That's right. Yep. Good point. Good point. That'll keep you enslaved for the rest of your life. And then you hear things like, well, I would have gone on that 12-step call, but, you know, I realized it would be codependent of me to do that because it wasn't a convenient time, so I didn't go because I don't want to be codependent, whatever the hell that means. And everybody nod, and yes, and this is the atmosphere that I came into AA. Went to Colorado, heard immense stories, realized I'd been missing the whole boat. So anyway, that's the background on this, and that's kind of why I dragged my feet for quite a while with this. I'd heard you can't make amends to people who have died. That's not true. I mean, here, okay, I'm going to go on record. You can make amends to dead people, okay? And I'll just quickly end with this and then give you whatever. My dad and I had a horrible time together. We never got along. I was a disappointment to him. I was kind of skinny, intellectual kid. You know, he was a great big guy, had been a great athlete, World War II vet, you know, on and on. And I was just a disappointment to him. I mean, I was a screw-up. You know, I don't know how to tell you any other way. I was just a screw-up. And I got kicked out of schools, and, you know, I told you I blew up the sewer and, you know, bought booze underage and went to, you know, just all this stuff. I was always messing up somehow or another. And we're going to fast forward. It's 1967, and my draft number has come up. I'm 19 years old. I'm the perfect age in the perfect year to go to Vietnam, except that I'm, you know, a revolutionary, you know, and I ain't going to Vietnam. And so I've got to go over here. Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn was my draft board. Probably a bunch of you guys had to go to Fort Hamilton. Or your older brothers did or something. So I'm going for my induction physical, and I'm having a little talk with my dad. And he's probably had a few nips by then. But he wasn't drunk. And I'll always remember this. And I said, you know, we're arguing about it. I'm not going to do that. You know, I'll go to Sweden. I'll go to Canada. I'll do any damn thing. And we're yelling at each other. And I say, I'm not going to go fight your racist war, you capitalist son of a bitch, you know. And so anyway, on with my life. I get out of the Vietnam thing because I've got a bum hip. You might have seen me limping around here, and it's been haunting me for years. But anyway, I get a 4F. I don't have to go. I'm on with my life, long career in drug and alcohol abuse. My dad dies in 73. He drops dead in Manhattan. He was, that's a long, God, I wish we had more time, I swear. My dad was part of the New York City Building Congress, which was all of the building industry in New York City, and he was a frustrated showman. He was a singer and dancer. He had a fabulous voice, and he always, you know, that's what he would have done. But he sold Caterpillar Tractor. That's what he did do. That's what, you know, he had to do to make a living. But what he would have done had he done his heart's desire was he'd have been a showman. He would have been in musicals and stuff. And the Congress had a Christmas show every year, and they had held it at the Waldorf, and he was always in it. He was always in it. Then he had a heart attack. He couldn't be in, but then he made a comeback, and he just loved it. He lived all year for this Christmas show that he did, and he was singing and dancing on stage at a place called the Lambs Club in Manhattan, where they had the final dress rehearsal. Now, he's doing that. I'm up in Harlem scoring heroin at the time. It's December 73, and I don't even have a telephone. I'm living on Long Island, and he drops dead of a massive coronary while he's singing and dancing on stage. I find out about it the next day because we didn't have a phone. Anyway, a lot of resentment towards my dad. You know, he never treated me right. No respect. Woof, woof. So we come back to, I don't know, it's a 6 years, 7 years sober, something like that. I think, no, maybe 5 years sober, I think. And we're up in Taos, New Mexico, and we're listening to a gal speak, and she talks about how she went to see her father when he was dying of cancer, and she told him everything about what her experience of living with him as an alcoholic dad was like, and then he shared stuff with her, and supposedly they had this catharsis, and it was all wonderful. So I tell Mary Thayer, well, I'm going to go to my dad's grave in Kentucky, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to tell him what it was like. And Mary Thayer, there's this silence, you know, and she says, well, that doesn't sound like amends to me, you know. And I'm thinking, well, screw you, I'm doing it anyway, you know. I know better than you do. So I go to my dad's grave, and actually I went to visit my mother, and she had broken her hip and was in the hospital, and so I had time on my hands, and I'm at the cemetery. And I start talking to my father, and I start praying. And instead of this scenario I had about telling him how awful it was, I start asking for his forgiveness and telling him how absolutely sorry I am for the disappointment that I was to him, you know, and just how I know I could have, I wished I'd been a better son, and I appreciate everything he did for me and how hard he worked and this and that. And it just flipped, and it wasn't of my doing. I swear it wasn't. And I'm crying and I'm praying, and the guys are mowing the grass out there, and I'm hugging the grave and crying and all that jazz. And it was a sweet deal, and I got up, and from it, I was there about 2 hours, and I thought, I'm clean on this deal. You know, I'm clean. Well, oftentimes there's more to the story, and in this case there was. And about 3-4 years later, I think it was, Juanita and I went to the movies in Santa Fe, and we saw this movie called Saving Private Ryan. If you've never seen it, it's extremely graphic stuff about World War II, okay? And I'm looking at it, and at the end of the movie, they've got the paratroopers in France who are, like, hanging there, and all of a sudden it comes to me. And my dad was a paratrooper in France. You know, he was, like, 17 years old when he went into World War II. He bribed a draft board. He had high blood pressure. He bribed a guy at a draft board to let him into World War II, you know, so that he could fight for his country, right? And he was one of these guys that just hung there, and the German... like the fifth columnist or whatever, the guys who got left behind would take pot, the snipers would take pot shots at these guys, often kill them while they were hanging there, you know. And he's like 18 years old, and I get this image of my father doing this, and my next thought is, what a punk he must have thought I was. Can you imagine? This is a guy who bribed a draft board so he could fight for his country, and his oldest son is telling him, I'm not, you know, you capitalist pig and all this crap. And it just broke my heart. It killed me. Just absolutely killed me. So I went back to the grave. I had another trip back to the grave. And I said, God, I am so sorry. You know, I had no idea. I was so wrapped up in me, you know, and my crap, that I never once thought of what that must have been like for you and how your heart must have broken, you know, to go through that. And please forgive me, you know, and know that I wouldn't have done that, you know, had I known better, and I had the power to do better. And, you know, I just can't tell you how sorry I am. And I got straight on it. You know, I know I was talking straight to his spirit. And when I left that time, I was absolutely clean, okay? I mean, I was done with it. And I felt, and I still today, I feel like my dad is with me right now, you know. Whew. I feel like at times he's been pulling for me. I feel like Don Pritz is pulling for me. And, you know, I feel like I've got an angel in heaven or something, you know. And it's good. You know, it's clean between us. I've been back to that grave. There's no pull at all. There's no hook whatsoever. That wasn't the end of the amends, though. There was a little bit more to it than that. I had, you know, I had gotten down on some NOM vets when they came back, you know. I wasn't one of these that called them baby killers and all this, but I was pretty close to that, you know. And the amends weren't settled yet. And something that God has blessed me with is that we've got a, about 2 hours from where we live in Angel Fire, New Mexico, is a monument a memorial to the Vietnam veterans. It's the best one. You might have been to the wall or whatever. If you've never been to Angel Fire, you never seen the real deal. This is a sacred space. It's an old Native American vortex, and they built this thing right on it. It's unbelievable. And what I've been able to do is take, I know some of you know Mark H., who has spoken here. I took him, and I've taken a bunch of NAM vets up there and sat with them and held their hands while they cried, and they healed from some of what happened to them in Vietnam. And what a gift, you know. And I've taken, sometimes we'll do these fifth steps and we'll just start driving, you know, for miles and miles because it gets toxic sitting there listening to a fifth step. And I always tend to gravitate up there to and we go up to the memorial, whether they're NAM vets or not. And I've taken the sons of Vietnam veterans and had them sit there and cry when they realized what their dads had to experience, you know. And there's been some tremendous, tremendous healings. I have an affinity for Vietnam veterans. Some of my best friends in AA are NAM vets. I love them. They're the greatest, you know. They gave everything. And so I feel like that's put to sleep, you know, that whole thing has been finished now, you know, and we've come full circle with that. And it's just, you know, if you're open to it, what can happen is just unbelievable, you know. What we've talked about this weekend is the tip of the iceberg, you know. I mean, it's just, I wish I could sit with you for 2 weeks and share everything, you know, that we've been through and the stories we've heard. But we can't. And it's 1 o'clock or close to it. And I just want to thank you. This weekend has been really good for us. I think it's really been healing for us. And the energy from you guys is tremendous. You know, I've met so many of you that I wished I could spend more time with and really get to know better. You know, if you come to Santa Fe, you're welcome to come see us. I tell you, I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And thanks for everything. Thanks for my life. And thank you.
Thank you. Tom said I got 5 minutes. Okay, so I'll take it. I always did like to get the last word in anyway. We've done some 11 step stuff here twice. Did a little morning meditation and prayer. The other piece of the 11th step is the night review. And I'm not going to read it. It's there on page 86. So take a look at that, because the 11th step begins there. As we did the morning meditation stuff, and I took you through the prayers, I just took page 86, 87, 88, and turned those pages into prayers. I also added to the morning prayer meditation, from the 9th step, the page before the promises, where it says, every morning we ask in meditation for God to show us tolerance. Well, what did I say? We ask God, blah, 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 blah. We ask each morning meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. And I've added that into my morning prayers because it says to. I've taken from step 10 and added, I've made some things into prayers, and one of it is that for God to help me grow in understanding and effectiveness. That's my function of the 10th step. And I've added also that God grant me the ability to grow in love and tolerance. And then I love the prayer that's in there on page 85 from the 10th step. And I've taken this and I've turned it into a prayer, and I've added the prayer where it says, I ask God to grant me the ability to carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. How may I best serve you, God? Your will, not mine, be done. And from a vision for you, where it says on the last page, 164, we ask him in our morning meditation, another prayer it says for me to do in meditation in the morning, that what I can do each day for the man who is still sick. So that's my morning prayers. Step 10, I told you about what I like to do with the bedevilments in the second on the bless you on the second step, which is I begin to create a vision. I ask God to help me create a vision for who I am and how my life and my personal relationships are going to be. So as I begin the 10th step and I look at the vision of God's will for me, I look at that list and I ask God if there's any changes that need to be made. And if so, I revise it. When I was about 5-6 years in the program, I was coming home from a meeting one night and I thought, what is my vision for God's will for me? And I had this little idea. I thought, well, you're Hispanic. You've got some Native American. How about this little house where you have, you know, a couple of women in there, and, you know, you help them change their lives, and you help their families change their lives, and, you know, you little by little, twos by threes, right, by twos and by threes. Well, I thought about this a little bit more for about another 4 or 5 seconds, and at the end of those 4 or 5 seconds, I'd gone nationwide with these little houses. And I started to laugh, and I thought, okay, God, that's pretty egotistical of me. What is it that you'd really have for me? What's my vision? What is the vision? And I got it, and it was very simple at the time, and it was, you know, just be the best wife you can be. Not the best, okay? There's a difference. Because I always had to be the best friend, the best employee, the best wife. It was the best that you can be, your personal best. Loud and clear, honey. I got it. Thank you. It's changed throughout the years, and what it is today is my vision is that I be an example of God's power, God's love, and God's way of life. That's my vision of God's will for me, and I hope that that's what I've done. The 10th step also speaks about the sixth sense. I knew about sight, hearing, taste, feeling, smell. Sixth sense, that's the spiritual connection. That's the vital sixth sense that I'm to develop if I'm going to live in the fourth dimension, which is the spiritual dimension. The last little piece I want to leave with you. Is on page 18. And we've been sharing with you this weekend about how, basically, how we do the 12 steps. And hopefully have given and conveyed to you a message of hope, which is what we try to do. Leave a message of hope with hopeless people. And hopeless people can be at any point. You don't have to be new. You can have 20, 30 years in any program and still have hope, hopelessness. Page 18, the bottom, is what I believe we do with each other and what I do with my sponsees. It says, we have... The man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty that he obviously knows what he's talking about. I hope you know that I know what I'm talking about, that Tom knows what he's talking about, and that our whole department shouts at you that we are a man that have found a real answer, that we have no attitude of holier than thou. In fact, you know what? We're just a couple of lamos just up here doing this deal. You know, we know very little. All we have is our experience. That we have nothing except the sincere desire to be helpful. That's it. There are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. And these are conditions that we have found most effective. And I hope that is what we have done here with you this weekend. I know that's what we try to do and what we set out to do. And we are just pleased as anything to have been here with you this weekend. And God bless you and thank you all. Been a ball.